The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
All right, let's go to the second part of the chapter, the cleansing of the temple. And here I do want to say a little bit about apparent historical problems we have. One of them has to do with the objection that when the people say in verse 20, the Jews said that this temple was built in 46 years, that appears to be some kind of historical error. To my mind, this is a classic pseudo-problem. It's a pseudo-problem where we get overly concerned about things that you know, a normal, sympathetic reading should not lead you to think of it in those terms. The problem, as you know, is that strictly speaking, the temple was not completed until about the year 63 AD, and here we're more than 30 years earlier. How could the Jews say this temple was built in 46 years? And then some individuals who are troubled by the problem and they're taking it seriously begin to come up with ways of translating the passage that seems to obviate the problem, and that, again, I don't think it's really the right way of approaching it. We do not even have to do what, say, Raymond Brown does. He appeals to the Septuagint of Ezra, chapter 5, verse 16, which he translates as follows. From that time until now, the temple has been in building. And then he says, you see, you have an error there as well. But the proper way of understanding it has been in building without any implication that it is complete. In fact, the text goes on to say, and it is not yet finished. I'm not saying that's an invalid parallel. I'm just saying that I am not convinced that you need to be that concerned about this issue. Why? Well, as everybody acknowledges, the basic structure of the temple had been completed. In fact, there is some evidence that about the time of Jesus, there was a serious problem with unemployment. And by serious, I'm talking about, you know, what, 20-25% unemployment perhaps, mainly due to the fact that much of the temple structure had been completed, and so these people had been laid off. So it would make all the sense in the world to speak about the possibility of its destruction. You know, it's been built to a sufficient place that you can intelligibly say this will be destroyed and then rebuilt. And that kind of language, moreover, would make even greater sense from an end of the century perspective. You're looking, you know, back from the end of the first century, and to use this language is just the common way in which you would have expressed it. Besides, often these difficulties arise because we do not have the whole complex of nuances and indications that you normally have in oral speech. Suppose that you were to paraphrase it this way. It's taken a full 46 years to build this. Dash. In fact, it isn't finished yet. Dash. And yet you claim you can erect it in 3 days. Now, if you leave out that parenthetical comment in dashes, you have basically the same thing the Jews said. It's taken a full 46 years to build this, and yet you claim you can erect it in 3 days. That's what the Jews said. But you can insert such parenthetical remark, and the sentence still makes sense. I mean, in ordinary speech, we talk this way. So I just cannot get too excited about trying to make this thing fit whatever historical data we have. But there is the other problem, of course, in this passage, which is a much more serious one, and that's the apparent contradiction with the synoptics, which place the cleansing of the temple at the very end of Jesus' ministry, not at the beginning. Now, in the history of the modern history of interpretation, the question of the cleansing of the temple has become, it would be very interesting for somebody to write a master's thesis or something, trying to survey the way in which evangelicals have approached this problem. I would say that 30 years ago, the question of how many cleansings of the temple was one of the standard shibboleths. You know, you can tell whether somebody's an evangelical or not on the basis of whether that person thinks there's one, there was only one, or there were two cleansings. Nowadays, you have lots of people who consider themselves evangelicals and who even argue for inerrancy and who are willing to concede that John may be talking about the very same cleansing. There was only one cleansing, but for literary purposes, he is locating it at the beginning of the gospel. Now, let's just for a moment bracket out the question of the authority of Scripture or some of our basic concerns with historical reliability and so on, and ask, okay, what would be the arguments in favor of saying that there were two cleansings and not just one? So, in other words, that Jesus actually cleansed the temple twice. John gives us the first one, and the synoptics give us the second one. What arguments can be used in support of that? Well, one of them, and you can see this in Morris's commentary, is that when you look carefully at the passages and you compare them, it is evident that many of the details are different. And of course, you know, this has been a standard way of approaching other similar problems. If you're comparing Matthew and Mark, or Mark and Luke, or whatever, and you're faced with the problem, say, was there one Gadarene or two Gadarenes, you know, that kind of thing, and you're trying to solve that problem, and sometimes the solution appears to be, well, maybe there are two different events that are being described. And the way that you go about determining that is by showing that there are enough differences that are best explained by saying that there were two different accounts. One gospel gave us one, the other one gave us the other. Now, that kind of argumentation, while I'm not willing to say that it is invalid, by itself is not fully persuasive, particularly when you're dealing with an event that obviously plays an important role in the gospel tradition. And the one way of looking at it is this: what is the probability that in the gospel tradition Jesus did two things that were very similar but were actually two different things? And yet, one gospel writer describes one of those events, the other gospel writer describes the other of those events. That it can happen, but how likely is it that if they're both, you know, conveying the same basic quote-unquote synoptic tradition, one is going to choose one and the other one will choose the other? can happen. I'm saying that, this kind of argumentation by itself is not fully persuasive. In the case of John, it's even more problematic because there's so many things about the life of Jesus and in his ministry which appear different in John. I mean, if you follow this line of argument to its logical conclusion, you would say the Jesus that John talks about is a different Jesus, you know, because there's so many differences in the way he speaks and the things he says and the kind of style he uses and so on. So without suggesting that it has no validity whatsoever, I think it needs to be dealt with very cautiously. A second argument would run this way. Everything else in the early chapters of the Gospel of John is missing in the synoptics. Remember? Because the synoptics begin their description of the ministry of Jesus after he's up north in Galilee. So the argument then goes like this. It is to be expected, because the synoptics are not describing anything that happened prior to the opening of the Galilean ministry. And so the fact that the synoptics do not describe this event is simply one more manifestation of that, and not the suggestion that it is the same event told in a different chronological context. A third argument that, to be perfectly honest, I'm not even sure just how this is used, has to do with the fact that in the synoptics, Jesus is in Jerusalem only once. Obviously, that's kind of a double-edged sword. You can use that in either direction. Arguments in favor of the view that there was only one historical cleansing of the temple, and that it is being described differently in the synoptics from the way it is in John, a couple of basic arguments. One is that for Jesus to do something so provocative at the beginning of his ministry appears inconsistent with the character of his ministry, at least the way that it appears. I mean, you read the synoptics, and he is avoiding people calling him Messiah, and there's no direct confrontation of this type. It's only when you get towards the end of his ministry that the confrontation becomes more explicit and more direct, and of course leads to his death. And to say that Jesus would have challenged the authorities of the temple so blatantly at the beginning of the ministry just does not seem to fit the character of what we know about Jesus otherwise. A second argument in favor of the one cleansing is that it is possible to interpret a chronological shifting of the episode on the basis of John's theological motivation and what he's trying to get across. The theme of newness, which is prominent in this part of the gospel. I mean, what could be more fitting if you're trying to get across the notion that the coming of Jesus means the passing away of the old order and the establishing of a new order? There's nothing that brings that out more clearly than the role of the temple in Judaism. And particularly if John is writing at a time subsequent to the destruction of the temple, it would have all the more impact for Jews in his day. I myself how should I put this? I wouldn't go to the stake on the basis of whether there's one or two cleansings. Let me put it this way. Strictly speaking, if in fact there was only one cleansing of the temple that took place at the end of Jesus' ministry, and John is now placing it at the beginning of the ministry, strictly speaking, that is not terribly different from what apparently Luke does in chapter 4 of the Gospel in giving us that description of Jesus being in the synagogue in Nazareth, which most scholars believe is a passage that is paralleled in Mark chapter 6. In other words, that Jesus didn't really go back to Nazareth until about the middle of his ministry, or after it had been going on for a while, and that he received a response of unbelief, according to Mark 6. And as I say, many Lucan scholars, including a number of evangelical writers, argue that this is not two different events. Jesus, on two different occasions, Jesus went to Nazareth, and there was a negative response to him. But it is very important for Luke, and we have clear evidence in Luke of the way in which he does not follow strict chronological order. For example, I always used to be bothered by this. In chapter 1, Mary goes to see her relative, Elizabeth, because she's expecting a child. And if you follow the story strictly, we're told, and then Mary went back to Nazareth, and then John the Baptist was born. Now, what is the likelihood that Mary would have come, stayed 3 months with Elizabeth, and then have left just before the baby's born? That used to bother me a lot. Until I realized, hey, something similar happens in the book of Acts when we're told, what is it, at the end of chapter 11. About the famine is in chapter 11, but the death of Herod Agrippa is in chapter 12. And you can show that, strictly speaking, the famine was subsequent and so on. And you can see that Luke deliberately is doing a little bit of chronological shifting here and there, not because he doesn't have his facts straight, not because he's trying to distort the history, but because the line of the narrative would get disrupted. And so what he does is he finishes a story and then goes back and picks up on the other one. There was the story of Mary's visit to Elizabeth. He wants to wrap that one up, so he says Mary went back. Now, in a sense, he chronologically comes back, tells you about the birth of John the Baptist, because otherwise, if he leaves Mary there down in the hills of Horeb or whatever, it's going to be a little awkward to bring her back later in the narrative, you see. And similarly, in the case of Acts 11, 12. Within that pattern of doing things, it makes sense that Luke talks about Jesus' visit to Nazareth right after the baptism and temptation, because that incident in Nazareth is so programmatic, if you will, both of the character of Jesus' ministry and of the way in which that ministry is, what kind of response he gets. And so it serves in a powerfully thematic way to anticipate the subsequent material that Luke gives to you. What I'm saying is, strictly speaking, fundamentally, that is not different from what John is doing here if, in fact, he is placing the cleansing of the temple at an early point. Now, admittedly, even though it may be fundamentally the same sort of thing, this one is a lot more, it's a little more difficult to accept because of its significance or, whatever. So I am a little bit ambivalent about it. I don't feel that I have real strong arguments to deny that this is the same cleansing, but what can you say? I'm a Bob Jones graduate, so I can't quite dive all the way into it. Well, any questions about the historical issue here in chapter 2? With regard to the structure of this little, of this pericope, you notice that verse 12 appears to present something of a transition. After these things, he went down into Capernaum, both he and his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and he remained there for a short while, not many days. That's a transitional comment. Then you have the actual description of the cleansing in verses 13 through 17. Then you have a challenge from the Jews in verses 18 through 22. And then you have what I think can best be described as a sequel. Verses 23 to 25 are not an integral part of the story of the cleansing, but it is closely tied to it. And I think if you do view it in terms of a sequel, it may be helpful because there are a number of other passages in the Gospel of John that seem to have a similar structure, where you appear to have come to the end of the story, but then you have an additional brief paragraph about either something that happens subsequent to it or that in some other way is linked to what has just been described. And as you look at the progression of the narrative in this section, you see how it contributes to the progression of the narrative more broadly considered. Because you have first the incident in Cana, which is now, how shall I put it, it is being broadened. I mean, it isn't just the water of the cleansing of Judaism, but you're moving to something much more serious, much more pervasive. The temple, this is God's holy place. This is the great symbol of what Judaism is. And even that is going to suffer a change. So there's progression from Cana to Jerusalem, not only in terms of geographic movement, but theological movement as well. And in addition to that, the story of the cleansing of the temple plays a very important role in anticipating chapters 3 and 4, especially chapter 4. You remember that the question of the Samaritan woman, where shall we worship, in Jerusalem or in this mountain here? Well, if you've read chapter 2, you know the answer to that question. And that, by the way, is further support for the view that, you know, John is deliberately placing it before so that you can make the connection very, very clearly in your mind. With regard to the message of this chapter, or this passage rather, there are several things that I want to point out. One of them is what appears to me to be an allusion to Zechariah chapter 14. Now, one might not, I mean, there's, one might not be motivated to look at Zechariah 14 if it were not for the fact that there are other passages in the gospel that are clearly developing some of the ideas in that passage. You will recall that that whole chapter, which is the last chapter of the book, has a very, very dramatic eschatological orientation about what God is going to do in the end, the gathering all the nations to Jerusalem. the Lord will, verse 4, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, east of Jerusalem, and the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west, forming a great valley, with half of the mountain moving north and half moving south, so on. Then you go down to verse 8, on that day living water will flow out from Jerusalem. And of course, you know, by the time you get to verse chapter 4 and then chapter 7, the flowing water, you cannot help but think of this kind of passage. And so the second time you read the Gospel of John, things will begin to come together. And then finally, beginning with verse 16, the survivors from all the nations that have attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord God Almighty, and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. And that will have a strong bearing when we get to chapter 7, because chapter 7 talks about Jesus going to celebrate the tabernacles. If any of the peoples of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, they will have no rain. If the Egyptian people do not go up and take part, they will have no rain. The Lord will bring on them the plague he inflicts on the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. On that day, holy to the Lord will be inscribed on the bells of the horses, and the cooking pots in the Lord's house will be like the sacred bowls in front of the altar. Every pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be holy to the Lord Almighty, and all who come to sacrifice will take some of the pots and cook in them. And on that day, there will no longer be a Canaanite, says the NIV here, in the house of the Lord Almighty. However, the Hebrew word there, kenani, can also mean merchant. And the NIV, I think, has a note, doesn't it? Yeah, or merchant. And holiday, in his lexicon, gives merchant as the meaning of the word in this particular passage, also in Proverbs 31:24. And again, this is very subtle, no doubt, but you have all these merchants in the temple. You know that John is preoccupied by the theme of the Feast of Tabernacles and the implications that has. And already here in chapter 2, Jesus is fulfilling the command from chapter 14 of Zechariah. He's getting rid of the Kenani, see, in the house of the Lord. A little subtle, I say. I don't want to push this too hard. But I think in the context of all the other patterns that we will see, it is not at all a far-fetched idea that this is part of what's in mind. Second thing that I want to call your attention to is the quotation of Psalm 69, "The zeal of your house consumes me." Every time I teach either this course on John or Galatians, somewhere in the middle of the term, the library receives some big fat book in German, the Christologische Erfüllung der Schrift in Johannes Evangelium, the Christological fulfillment of Scripture in the Gospel of John. And of course, you expect me to read this. And I did take a look at what he had to say about the quotation, Psalm 69, and I couldn't make much sense of it, so I cannot tell you what he says about it. But I can tell you that here is one of those messianic psalms, messianic testimonia, that it is clearly important for John, because in chapter 19, verses 28 and following, he will refer to Psalm 69, and here is one of those messianic psalms, messianic testimonia, that it is clearly important for John, because in chapter 19, verses 28 and following, he will refer to Psalm 69, and what is it, verse 20? 21, they put gall in my food and gave me vinegar for my thirst. Of all the Gospels, John is the only one who links the ideas of thirst and vinegar. For John, this psalm is an important one. Now, I have to tell you that for me personally, this is an important psalm too. When I was still a young kid from college, I think it must have been, let me think here for a second, must have been between my junior and senior years in college. And I was, home, and I had my little study and looking at my books and Colin Delitzsch and all that stuff. And I don't know why I was sitting there, and all of a sudden I had this terrible idea. Well, you know, here are all these books, and some of them are pretty liberal books, and what if I end up being a liberal? And somehow, in the context of some of those troubling thoughts, I thought of Psalm 69, verse 6, and may those who hope in you not be disgraced because of me. Or maybe I happened to be reading that at the time, I don't know. O Lord, the God, the Lord Almighty, may those who seek you not be put to shame because of me, O God of Israel. And I kind of made that my prayer, you know, make sure this doesn't happen. But the thing about this psalm is that, you know how there are certain psalms that talk directly about the sins of the psalmist. Then there are other psalms that talk about the righteousness of the psalmist, and you have a little bit of difficulty kind of getting on board with, you know, Lord, you know that I have never done this and that and the other, and how righteous I am, and so on. The peculiar thing about this psalm is that it seems to share both of those ideas, and even more peculiar, as I'll point out in just a moment, that this psalm of all psalms should be chosen as one that reflects, in some respects, Jesus' own messianic work. You remember how it begins? Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. I sink in the miry depths where there is no foothold, and so on. And there's a fairly detailed description of how much he's suffering. And then verse 4, those who hate me without reason. There's no reason for them to do this. Outnumber the hairs of my head. Many are my enemies without cause, those who seek to destroy me. I am forced to restore what I did not steal. And then immediately he turns around and he says, of course, I'm not saying that I am totally free from guilt here. You know my folly, O God. My guilt is not hidden from you. And then verse 7, I endure scorn for your sake, and shame covers my face. I am a stranger to my brothers, an alien to my own mother's sons. And then this passage in the middle, for zeal for your house consumes me, and the insults of those who insult you fall on me. And so you have this passage quoted in John chapter 2, and verse 21 quoted in John chapter 19. And in addition to that, there is the way in which John 2 brings to realization one of the more significant eschatological themes in the Old Testament. I'm talking here about what you read in Isaiah chapter 56. I have this sermon called A Word to Foreigners and Eunuchs, and my wife keeps telling me I need to change the title of that sermon. But here are two classes of people, foreigners and eunuchs, who are supposed to have, you know, they belong to a category that makes them different. They appear to have a very tenuous relationship to God's, to the cult of Israel. And there's this incredible promise of verse 3, an assurance, let no foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord ever say, the Lord will surely exclude me from his people? Things have changed. Let no foreigner say that. And let not any eunuch complain, I am only a dry tree. I have no descendants. What's going to become of me? Because if my name doesn't succeed me, I'll be forgotten. And then you have this wonderful promise to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose what please me, and so on. To them I will give within my temple and its walls a memorial and a name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that will not be cut off. It is God's own name. And you have that promise in the book of Revelation, having the name of God on them. As far as the foreigners are concerned, if they bind themselves to the Lord to serve him, etc., 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 these I will bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices will be accepted at my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. And so you have the universal element brought into the work of Christ as he cleanses the temple. Now, this passage, of course, is not quoted here in John, but it is something that cannot be, you cannot lose perspective on that. You have several other passages where John is giving you a different perspective, to be sure. I mean, here you have the quotation from Psalm 69 rather than the one from Isaiah 56, but it would be a grave mistake to interpret, to think that these are mutually exclusive perspectives. Now, comparing the two can be very useful, and we don't have time to do a lot of that, but as you try to focus on the place that the cleansing of the temple has within the narrative of the Gospel of John and in the context of his theological concerns, how these Old Testament quotations are used become a very important clue. And I hope we have time to do a little bit more of that later on. A couple more things here. You have the issue of the request for a sign. In verse 18, what sign do you show us that you're doing these things? You might take a look at Dodd's book, pages 300 and 301. He helps you see that, strictly speaking, the destruction and rebuilding of the temple is not something that actually happens. In other words, there's something that the Jesus' hearers are being asked to look beyond. And when you take into account the way in which the conversation develops in a similar way, really, in chapter 6 of the Gospel of John, it may be that what is going on is that Jesus is inviting the questioners to see in the actual occurrence the sign that they desire. They're looking for a sign, and they're supposed to see it there, although, again, Jesus is a little bit concerned about the motivation of people asking for a sign. The way that Jesus responds to it, when he says, destroy this building, and I will raise it in 3 days, has at least a double meaning. You know, there's the natural meaning of the literal temple, and then there is the meaning of his resurrection. Now, with regard to his resurrection, that is pointed out explicitly for us, verse 22. When he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken. But it is also possible that the reference to the raising of the body might have some sort of allusion to the church as the body of Christ. Now, Carson doesn't accept this, in part because it is not explicit in the same way that the reference to the resurrection is made explicit here. But I am not quite that ready to exclude this particular allusion. Again, you have to think of at least part of the audience are going to be Christians who are part of the church, and the notion of the church as body is one that more than likely they would have been familiar with. And in an indirect way, when you put together other elements in the Gospel of John, what is going to happen when he gives his Spirit? Something is going to happen in the way in which his people are brought together, and we'll see that in great detail when we talk about the Upper Room Discourse. But I would acknowledge that that's not a central issue here. It's just that I think it does have some implications for that. The way in which the Jews misunderstand what Jesus is saying is very typical of the Gospel. Barrett, in his commentary, page 200, makes the point that these misunderstandings are more than a literary trick employed by a writer who is given to irony. This is not just playing with words and using irony for strictly literary reasons. Rather, says Barrett, they represent in miniature the total reaction of Judaism to Christ. The total reaction is that when the Jews hear the message, they seem able only to perceive the surface meaning, and they cannot get behind that surface meaning. Finally, the last thing that I want to call your attention to is the play on believe and do not believe. This is pretty critical, and I think it also anticipates what is about to come in chapter 3 with Nicodemus. We're told that during the Passover, poloi epistiusan, eisto onoma autu. Many believed in his name as they saw the signs that he was performing. And then this play on words, but Jesus himself, uk epistuen auton autois, he did not entrust himself to them, using the same verb, because he knew what was in all of them. He knew all of them. He had no need that anyone give witness concerning any man, because he knew what was in man. Now, as I'll point out next time, verse 25 ends with this phrase, en to anthropo, he knew what was in man. And then chapter 3 begins, en de anthropos, there was a man. I don't think that's coincidence or just the carelessness in repeating the term. John is explicitly linking that statement at the end of chapter 2 with the way in which he presents Nicodemus, and we'll have to ask what significance there may be to that. In fact, Beasley Murray, in his commentary, views chapter 2, verses 23 to 25, as the introduction to the Nicodemus narrative. Also significant, this is not so much, I guess it's also formal in a way, but the picking up of the theme of water. Now water, you came across in chapter 1 in connection with John's baptism, came up again in chapter 2 in connection with the water that was turned to wine. Now it surfaces again, only that here it is linked with spirit. And that combination, in effect, anticipates what will be said in chapter 4. So you see John, somewhat subtly, leading the reader, you see, preparing the reader for the way in which the narrative progresses. The whole of chapter 3 is often viewed as having a twofold structure, so that the first major section would be the interview with Nicodemus, verses 1 through 21. Oh, sorry, don't give that title yet. Let's say this. The first section is verses 1 through 21. The second section is verses 22 to 36. and that within each of those two sections you have a twofold structure, which consists, in the case of the first part of the chapter, first of all, the interview with Nicodemus, verses 1 to 15, followed by the comments of the evangelist in verses 16 to 21. And corresponding to that, in the second part of the chapter, you have first the testimony of John the Baptist, verses 22 to 30. And that is followed by some comments by the evangelists, verses 31 to 36. Okay, so verses 1 to 15, interview with Nicodemus, followed by the comments in 16 to 21. Second part of the chapter, the testimony of John the Baptist, 22 to 30, followed by the comments, verses 31 to 36. You can argue over that. I suspect the approach is not altogether wrong, but we need to recognize the difficulties in determining just where does the interview with Nicodemus end. Some people say it ends at verse 12, others at verse 15. And this problem of being able to figure that out tells us a good deal about the character of the Gospel of Jesus, or the Gospel of John, because as we noted before, Jesus seems to talk the way that John writes. And you cannot even tell for sure whether the words of Jesus have come to an end or not. As Raymond Brown puts it, page 149, all Jesus' words come to us through the channels of the evangelist's own understanding and rethinking. All Jesus' words come to us through the channels of the evangelist's understanding and rethinking. But, Brown continues, but the gospel presents Jesus as speaking and not the evangelist. That's an important point. In other words, you must not draw the inference that therefore, and this is the problem, you see, with calling it the evangelist comments. And I think the implication of what Brown is saying, although he isn't really explicit about that, is that maybe, you know, you really should take the whole thing as Jesus' statements, all the way to verse 21.